So very nice to see all these smiling faces. And also the ones who are not smiling, you don't have to smile. Just stay as you are. Be just natural. And then we can begin. So please sit comfortably if you're not already in such a position, upright and composed. A posture which expresses that sense of composure. And composure, of course, you could give that word additional meanings, means to be connected with our physical reality. We're connected with the earth element, particular. This body is of course, contains more water element than earth element, but the easiest way to establish a contact with our physical reality is via that element, which means we're feeling into our bodies. Just first of all, on one glance, what's the physical body like tonight? The overall energy level, is there a lack of energy, a felt lack of energy, or you have excess energy, or you feel rather balanced and at an equilibrium within yourself? And as always, we're not here to evaluate or judge, simply to note, to be conscious, or also to become more conscious if our attention is a little bit clustered or not quite as it could be. And then the body is a very valuable instrument to ground our attention in this physical reality. It's an excellent instrument, actually. Very often in spiritual circles, in Buddhist circles, there is talk about the mind, the heart. And of course, yes, that is important. But you should never leave out our physical reality, the physical body. We can establish now intentionally a connection from the right, from the bottom up, from your sitting surface, all the way through the spine, holding your body upright. Yeah, we have to hold our bodies upright. They don't do this all by themselves. Even though our spine helps a little bit to do that, otherwise we would be rather helpless to establish a straight posture at all. Can you imagine, especially those of you who may be quite good in visualizing an energy column, a column of light going through the center of our spine, center axis, all the way up, right up, into the head, to the top of the head, sometimes they help a little bit with our imaging or visualization, can help to establish this very clear perception of our corporeal reality, the reality of our bodies. grounding ourselves. And establishing what is commonly called an embodied presence instead of a disembodied presence, where we're just floating up into the sky, into ethereal realms. And of course, we can't avoid noticing the mental activity, anything which our mind is telling us, activity of thought, of thinking, that is to be acknowledged. But simply that, no additives added to them, we're just leaving the thinking for what it is simply mental activity, even if they communicate a sense of urgency or pressure. We know that, but we don't give in to it. We're simply letting the thoughts be themselves. If we let them, they look after themselves. They don't need us to look after them. And additionally, also the what we call commonly the heart, which of course it's useful to localize the physical heart, that area also in our body where we are very receptive and sensitive, where what we call the felt sense is most intimately noticed. But of course, it goes also beyond the area of the physical heart. We notice if anything is touching us, moving us, in the realm of feelings or even emotions, they also have the tendency wanting us to be engaged with them, to be occupied with them, to add commentaries to them, to embrace them when they're pleasant, or to fight them or resist them when they're unpleasant. But we don't do that. We simply note, receive these impressions as they are, and we leave them as they are. They're not the object of our observation, or just very briefly objects of our observation before we are leaving them to themselves. And then via that embodied presence, which we can always return to once we find ourselves straying away, getting on a sidetrack. It's a wonderful resource to always reconnect, re-embody ourselves. We're spinning off up into the sky, into the universe, round the globe and back again. The body is always here, and that's why it's so wonderfully reliable. And when we strengthen and develop this embodied presence, it also, of course, has an influence on our minds, on the quality of our attention. On the quality of presence in relation to the feelings, emotions, and thoughts, and the level of awareness the awareness of them gets stronger, it increases. And maybe eventually it replaces the old mode of being always immediately involved, immediately categorizing, judging, commenting, etc., etc. This is the task a meditator definitely has to learn, to train him or herself in this skill. It is a skill which we can all acquire. And it's also within the scope of our ability. It's not for only Superwoman or Superman, but every one of us can do this. Don't be too quick to judge yourself. If it doesn't work right from the start, as you want it to be, as you imagine it to be, be quite relaxed, but with a sense of resolve, keeping at it, not letting yourself just drifting off aimlessly. So please, for the remainder of the time, continue on your own accord. Most of you have already a toolkit of practices, meditation practices and skills at place. And of course, also you're free to open that toolkit if it seems suitable. So please orient yourself again in your physical environment. If you had the eyes closed, there won't be a bell. The bell is out of reach for me right now. So we're coming to the end of this meditation in this way. Looking around a little bit and reorienting again in the physical environment we're in. So I'd like to offer just a few words in relation to that, what we've just been doing and which we will hopefully continue to do for the rest of our lives. This is my wish for all of you, also of course for myself, but as I have all these supportive means in place, this doesn't have to be a very strong declaration, but for you out there, it certainly sometimes is. We've just finished, actually, last weekend on Monday, a meditation retreat, the first one this year, an Easter retreat for 5 days. And so roughly 20 people came to the monastery and really diligently engaged themselves with formal practice, and a very good group, very quiet group, I heard afterwards, because I can't really say how this actually looks when people meet each other in between the formal sessions. And so I had a very good impression of the external side of things, but then on the internal side of things and what goes on in people's hearts and people's minds, that's of course a different story. People can look very, very composed and incredibly mindful and focused and so forth, which of course could be a sign that we're really with it, they're really with completely connected with the inner processes and don't even sway away for a millisecond. But I can't, of course, tell. I'm not a mind reader, so I can't really tell if that's what everyone's reality is. And of course, I can assume that the reality for each and everyone is usually very different. All the different impressions which arise in consciousness differ all the time. We receive a whole variety of impressions continuously. If we're not out there in the busy world, in the external world, going after our occupations, but retreating to a monastery, so then the inner world becomes more visible, more feelable, one could say. And this is the whole point of it, isn't it? The whole point of it is to make actually clear or to become aware of what actually constitutes our mundane inner reality. And as I could hear from many comments and so forth, that a lot of the topics which come up during the meditation in the course of a few days have to do with issues in the area of challenging emotions, challenging emotional life. It's far less to do with, you know, most high and refined states of consciousness. Nobody actually asked the questions of in the area of the arupa jhanas, you know, the immaterial absorptions, or even the material absorptions. Not that that was on offer on the teaching side, but still people sometimes, of course, practice like that. But during this retreat, it wasn't. It was a lot of, you know, the kind of mundane stuff which each and every one of us is dealing with every day, you know, the everyday stuff. But under the highlight of an increased focus, and also over time, as we delve into it, also with increased awareness. And of course, the encouragement always is to check how tempted we are, how quickly tempted we are to get immersed, and also to get, we could say, identified with our inner processes. Actually, I remember there's a nice little story out of Ajahn Chah's life where it was quite more towards the end of his life. He was already a very well-known teacher in Thailand with lots of people coming to his monasteries, and he was well-known for having lots of time every day. He was sitting there for hours receiving guests and of all walks of life, you know, from the highly educated urban people to very normal, ordinary peasants, people who do the farming every day and so forth, and everything in between. And he's also renowned for, of course, his accomplishments. That's why he got so famous. People had the impression, well, this man has used his life to the best of his abilities. He's truly wise. Not only wise, he's all very compassionate, but also just on the mundane level, a very relaxed appearance, very friendly and so forth. So people already at that time were holding Lompo Cha in very high regard. And one day there was a man in the audience who was always looking very intently at Ajahn Chah's hands, because Ajahn Chah liked to also gesticulate when he gave a Dhamma presentation. And this man, by profession, one of his professions was he was a palmist, you know, a palm reader, maybe also a psychic or some kind of astrologer. And in Thailand, you have oodles of these people, and they love to go to the monasteries and sometimes love to tell the monks what they still need to work on, some of them. But this one was, of course, very impressed by Lompo Cha, and he was very hesitant and shy, but in the end, he couldn't avoid it. But he asked Ajahn Chah, please forgive me for asking you, but I'm a palmist, and I'd really like to have a look at your palms, if you allow me to have a closer look." And Ajahn Chah grunted a little bit, because he was very often a bit fed up of all these people, you know, who was pulling tricks on him and wanting to get lottery numbers out of him, so forth. And he said, "Well, if you want lottery numbers, then we won't do this." And so he promised not to have anything to do with lottery numbers. So Lompo Cha showed him his palms, and he looked at it quite intently. And suddenly, you know, he put his glasses on and looked very closely at the lines, and suddenly he exclaimed, "Oh, Paul, this is astonishing. This is very astonishing. You seem to have a lot of anger." And I don't know what the other people were thinking who were sitting around. But Ajahn Chah, he took this in, this comment, and said very quietly, "Yes, I do, but I don't use it." And so that was a very interesting answer, huh, from a highly regarded master, whom probably most people thought, nothing to do with anger, this man, you know, it's finished, one and for all gone, and practice over a lifetime. From a very young age, he was living a monastic life and practicing, and so most people would probably think this should be the result at the end, and also they would get the scriptural support, no more anger, no more greed, no more delusion. That's the sign of an accomplished one, of an arahant. Or maybe let's take one stage before the arahant, an anagami. It's also already quite a long way along, and just needs a little bit more to realize full awakening. But of course, we don't know if this was just a kind of didactic trick by Ajahn Chah, or, you know, if what he really thought or felt in this moment, but certainly a very interesting comment. Huh? "Yes, I do. There's anger, but I don't use it." Which actually in common parlance, one could say, is not at all identified with anger. And maybe you could even use the other defilements as well, you know. They're there, but they're not used. This person is not involved at all. So would you consider this a free mind, a free heart, someone who speaks like that? Or would you say, but maybe if you just in an unmindful moment looks left or right, you would see an angry moment or a greedy moment or a fearful moment or so? Couldn't it be like that? And also, what about maybe we are all wrong in our perception of this teacher? Maybe we just imagine something about his accomplishments which are not quite up to scratch, which are not quite according with reality. Well, one could assume at this stage, in this latter stage of his life, that Ajahn Chah certainly, flippantly, one could say, had finished his business. There was no more egoic identification with the processes of his mind. And from what can we guess that? Well, we're not guessing. We hear many reports of people living very close with him, countless encounters and conversations, so forth, who prove for this person, greed, hatred, and delusion are no more his business. He's not concerned with this. And so what do we do? What do we do with a statement like that? Of course, definitely, we would not take this and start to pretend something in the end on the way of our practice, which we're not, which we haven't realized. But honesty, truthfulness, a very important ingredient of the spiritual life. So we should always acknowledge what our reality actually is. And maybe for some of us, maybe even for all of us, maybe a little smidgen of anger now and then, every second Thursday or so, is something which has to do with our reality. And then usually that's a hint, that's a pointer, There's more looking, there's more sensing, there's more feeling into it necessary to disguise this culprit, huh? This culprit of whatever defilement it is. Because through this precise looking, precise seeing, or as we always say, through conscious awareness, we can go beyond this phenomena. We're not in the grip of this phenomena. This is a very simple advice, actually. I hope it doesn't sound complicated. It's a very simple advice, just turning to it with this faculty which we all possess, which we all have, but maybe some of us will admit, which we too rarely use, which very often slips away in our daily life when the daily business takes over. And then only now and then we remember, we realize, oh, okay, there's this faculty of conscious awareness. Sometimes, you, for example, in a situation where you're doing very focused work, like a lot of people these days sit all day in front of computer screens. And what is the effect of that? You get very absorbed, huh? You get very focused on the screen. So it's all your attention, your energy is all up here, all day, sitting here, focusing on that, what's going on the screen. Sometimes it's kind of written material, maybe, stuff you have to work through. Sometimes you're in a conference, but also even then when you're in a conference, the meeting of hearts is a different story this way, as we're doing tonight, as it is when we're meeting a real person, isn't it? That's why it was such a relief last weekend on the Easter retreat to actually have real people, real bodies, breathing bodies in the room, which I could sense, you know, as the person in the front. And I wouldn't get just the written down messages. There were lots of written down messages because we had a question basket. But there's also a sense I get from looking at people, sensing them, feeling them. And that's very important too. Even though very often I don't sit there and labeling everything I perceive, I just get an impression on the felt sense level. And that and the verbal impact or the written message gives me more of a clue what people are actually dealing with in their life, or in this specific situation on a meditation retreat, or for us, when we're sitting and working, say, very head focused, it's very good from time to time, in fact, develop a discipline to pull back at least for a few moments now and then, maybe making it a regular habit, you know, maybe having a little bell reminding one every hour or so, okay. Have a break. Just go into the body. Go into the felt sense. Huh? What's the feeling sense like right now? Because we do tend to forget that when our focus is very much up here, huh? Head-based in the cognitive level. And this way, this is also a part of training. It's not just the training on the meditation cushion, on the meditation walking path, but this is the training one can do in normal life, in ordinary life. And this will certainly enrich and inform our overall practice. And then the gap between our normal life and when you get home in the evening, so when you sit down and you devote yourself to formal practice, it won't be so big. You won't have so much to process before actually your mind settles. And you can actually attend to more subtle things. And then further, of course, to attend to the theme I mentioned in the little story with Lompo Cha, yeah, that we can actually detect ourselves on a more subtle level, where and how we identify with our inner processes, with our inner world. And then, of course, in the long run, learn how to de-identify. And to de-identify doesn't mean to split off our consciousness, to become unconscious or half-conscious, or to suppress go into suppression strategies, but it means to become more conscious, become more aware, so that nothing in due course, nothing will slip our attention. And we notice, there's a train of thoughts which is informed by a sentiment of anger or of fear, of anxiety and so forth. So rather than following the train of thought, we go to the felt sense. What's this fear telling me? And as soon as we do that, as soon as we attend to it as an object, as an activity, simply occurring, moving through, in that moment, we are not identified, at least for the time with attending in that way. And this also is a training. This way we train ourselves to do this regularly and disengage more and more from the habit patterns in relation to our mental, emotional world, which we have developed over a lifetime. And admittedly, we could say this is quite a task. Most of us have noticed that the habits we all have are quite strong. Some of us actually have even the sense that we feel we are victims of our habits, we feel helpless, can't seem to overcome them and so forth. Maybe we then overlook that we are impatient, or we ask, we have too high demands, putting too high demands on ourselves. We're wanting things to change, to transform ourselves too quickly. These are then the secondary defilements, come in. We're dealing with a kind of challenging feeling of anger or fear and so forth. And then maybe comes the undercurrent of, well, I should have gone beyond that, or at least weakened that energy a long time ago. Why is it still coming and visiting me in that kind of intensity as it is tonight? The why questions, of course, we have to be careful with, because that leads us in the head again, asking why, finding causes in the kind of obscure past of our lives. Some people even go beyond this life, but that's a futile project. There's so many things, there would be so many things to consider. So many things could be a kind of reasonable explanation on the cognitive level. But the solution actually lies in the direct quality of awareness we give ourselves at any given moment. There also is the transformative place. This is where things change and move. Our bad habits can slowly be changed into good habits, or as we call them in Buddhism, wholesome habits. The unwholesome habits can subside. We're doing our best to let them subside, or bring them into a position where they occur less, and the good habits become stronger. And also on the Eightfold Path, the Buddhists among you will know that this is called right effort. The right effort in walking this Eightfold Path.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I hear you very well.
Oh, good. So my question, something that comes up a lot, is I try to concentrate on focusing on how one feels, not why one feels that way. Focusing on how, but not why. And I know that meditation shouldn't be psychoanalysis. But I wonder, when you get in your own practice, when you switch to examining the causes of feeling, as opposed to just sensing that anger is present and sadness is present.
Yeah. Well, of course, we don't have our discriminative wisdom is not completely switched off. We always can notice that maybe we have a habit, a certain habit in what triggers off anger, for example, as we're talking about anger, or fear and so forth. And that, of course, can be analyzed, And I would actually even say that certain therapeutic approaches can actually be quite complementary for people, especially if they if they're dealing with really strong stuff, you know, which they also find very difficult to hold with awareness because it's overwhelming, overpowering. And it usually then might be a sign that it's a good idea to, you know, seek someone to speak with. Huh? But to come back to the application of meditation practice, we don't want to use this to get into the headspace, so to speak, to become analytical there, because one of the things also occurring there is you can never be sure about the answers you're getting via the headspace. You can have the impression that you're really scrutinizing the causes for kind of defiled emotion, but you might also be fooling yourself. It could well be. So that's why the more analytical approach, going to the real causes, say maybe you have a trauma in the past, you know, in your life, early on in your life, something awful happened in your childhood and so forth. For those very powerful things, usually it's advisable to have the help of someone else sitting opposite you who can actually stop you at the right moments and then lead you gently deeper to uncover, you know, the underlying problem or trauma. But in, say, more common ordinary meditation where they're not so incredibly challenging things on the screen, I would propose to not do that, to not go into analysis, you know, and more looking at the tendency or maybe the temptation we're under to identify, or, you know, our preference even to identify certain things we like to identify, actually, certain things which are not really very good for the progress on the path. We like to identify, we like to become that or own that, as we say in Buddhist parlance, you know. So it's good to check that, become aware of that when we very, very easily move into some state where we eventually we start to cling, start to grasp and cling. And when we start to grasp and cling, we become that, you know, we literally get born in that state. And then eventually we will suffer because all states of mind, all emotional states cannot last. The ones we want to stay definitely cannot last. And the ones we want to go, want to not stay, they tend to stay on the basis of our resistance because we resist them. And then they tend to hang around and visit us again and again and again until we give up that resistance, you know, that persistent resistance. In certain things, we are very persistent when it comes to unwanted feelings, unwanted emotions. So, you know, to trust in this quality, I mean, you know, as you know, the quality of mindfulness or awareness is made a lot of these days in many fields of life. And but here in this context, it's in put into the service of the gradual awakening. At least that's why we talk now. Of course, there's also something which we call spontaneous awakening, but we can't book on that. We can't count on that. But for most of us, actually, the process of awakening is a gradual process where we, you know, familiarizing ourselves more and more and more with the intricacies of our experience, you know, the finer nuances of our feelings, emotions, and also thought patterns, the evaluations, the additives we add to it. All that is also good to know and acknowledge, huh? Because only if we know it consciously can we, do we actually eventually have a choice to not do it. And that's would be a valuable position to be in, you know, to say something comes up, no, I don't go there. I know you, you know, like the Buddha said to Mara, I know you, Mara, I don't go there. I've done this enough. It hasn't brought me anything. In fact, it has brought me pain. So why should I repeat this, you know? So we are that, you know, that commonsensical in a way. We're not trying to create anything artificial or special. We're being very straight, very down to earth, very practical. Does that speak to you, Aries?
It did.
Yeah, okay. Anything else?
I'll always ask a follow-up question if possible. I've gone back to the Satipatthana Sutta. I've been meditating twice daily for about 3 years. I've gone back to the beginning again. Or I don't know if that's necessarily the beginning, but back to the foundational practice.
Did I hear right, the Satipatthana Sutta?
Right. I've gone back to that again to try and start again from the beginning. And I always wonder, when emotions come up, like you say, I'm going to focus on the breathing.
Mm-hmm.
When emotions come up, when you're focusing on the breathing or mental formations, how rigidly should you stick to that concept as opposed to investigating new things that arise? So in a concentration meditation, I know you should acknowledge that they're present and go back to the breath or whatever. But I do often wonder if these keep coming up, when it's worthwhile to switch to another topic.
Well, yes. This can be a very nagging doubt, isn't it, in your meditation? And of course, on one level, you know, nobody can tell you exactly, you know. Of course, ideally, we always want to have a good basis and a sense of stability and calm in the mind. And we cannot say there is not a really a measure of 1 to 10, you know, to what degree we should be calm and centered and you know, focused and so forth. It's impossible to say that. And so it's up to us to sense, you know, when is the good time to investigate. And you sense it very often when maybe something comes, either, of course, it's obvious when you already feel very centered before you start, then you could actually devote the whole session towards an investigation of a theme which is actually very much on your mind, which very quickly, as soon as you sit down and you focus in with this theme, will come. Maybe some emotional challenge has happened in your life also, you know, and then there you are, you're looking at that, but you're not looking at it in a, as we spoke earlier, in a thinking manner, but more on a felt sense level, and see the kind of temptations you might have to get identified with that or with the derivatives coming from that. But then in the middle of, say, the breath meditation, body meditation, then you're coming to a certain point where you can generally say, open up for my experience. Say, maybe from the focus approach, the Taylor lens to the wide angle, you're using a photographic analogy, you know, rather honing in on one particular realm, that is the breath in the body, we opening up and say, what is this mind like? And that's actually the third aspect, the third category, isn't it? Then we have mental, emotional states to witness, and preferably, of course, under the heading of just witnessing, just noticing, just observing, not getting caught up, not getting involved, not getting identified. And then if we notice again that we're tossed around by the events and we don't really see clearly, maybe that's a sign we would go back to the more kind of the collected aspect, collect our energies together, using the body, breath, and so forth to do that. And so forth, in one level, also the separation between the samatha, you know, which is the breath meditation, and then the vipassana, the insight meditation, or the meditation leading to insight, they belong together. And this famous image, Lompo Cha also, as I mentioned him tonight, used to bring was the just like two sides of the same hand, just depending where you look, you have either this one or you have that one. And of course, yeah, what can nobody take away from you is to decide when to turn over, when to turn around, you know. That is up to us to develop the skill to see, okay, I feel really centered, calm within myself. So what are the issues? What is in the mind? What's the contents? What's actually, you're actually consciously giving the contents your attention. Rather than ignoring the contents, which of course you tend to do when you're getting focused on a meditation object like the breath. Then you're screening, at least you're trying to screen the contents out, which might not be, of course, depending on how experienced you are, might not be very good, very successful in the beginning, but eventually you will, you know. Some people are extremely good at that, actually. They can block out even the most traumatic emotional issues. In the long run, of course, that is dangerous. It can really go off in the wrong direction. But temporarily, you know, this might be okay until you notice, oh, there's really something else I have to attend to. No? I can't just meditate the rest of my life and get deeper and deeper in my samatha practice, in my focus practice. But I need to also open up and see what is this person actually experiencing? What mental and emotional states are actually preferably occurring and keep visiting regularly? So maybe I should give those, and based on the strength of that focus, I have developed more intimate attention, so that they can be liberated from me, or I can be liberated from them, however you want to see it. Well, that's the direction we go. We're not trying to get deeper, you know, as an end in itself with samatha practice, but it's a preparation, you could say, preparing the ground to then, you know, attending to the emotional mental processes inwardly. Is that good enough?
That's very helpful. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And in a similar way, maybe as we ended that retreat I mentioned, we always end the coming together in the Dhamma context on a good note, on a positive note, on a wholesome note. The end of retreat is an extensive metta bhavana meditation, but also it doesn't have to be always very extensive. We can just bring to mind the initially, at least conceptually, the concept of metta, benevolence, of kindness, loving kindness, if you want, or even love, if you want. And this time, during these times, challenging times on many levels, which we as a humanity experience right now, during this historical period, we can manifest, we can generate some benevolence, some goodness, some loving kindness, not only to ourselves and to the immediacy of our environment, the people we're living with, the people we're connected with, the people who we form friendships with and relationships. But we're letting this metta getting big, getting expansive. As you know, it is commonly known as a limitless quality. There is no limit to the way this energy can be spread out, unless we set the limits, unless we exclude only one person from our kindness, our benevolence, then this limitless quality is lost. And so you can start and with those folks which are close to you, personally close, the work sphere, your relatives, family, and then broach out further. To your immediate physical environment, the place you're living in, the village, the city, the country, including also the non-human beings, especially the animals, which we're sharing this planet with and who have such a hard time under us, sharing our benevolence and kindness with those, all those creatures. And wishing everyone, every breathing creature well from our heart. This can be done limitlessly, including everything, everyone, every creature out there, which not only breathes, but in particularly which feels. So not only humans feel, but animals feel in just the same way. So we extend it also to those. And who knows who else is out there, huh? We're going even further beyond planet Earth into the vast universe. Whoever is listening in from out there, they also include it. May they also be well, may they be free from all forms of suffering. May they find the release of true awakening of Nibbana. Same for us as well.